This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. This is the final of three chapters recorded with our friends Diane and Arlen Donald. Welcome to episode 204 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So announcements this week. What do we got for announcements?
Not necessarily. Well, it is news. It's not news that Outlander is coming to San Diego Comic-Con.
That would be news.
That would actually be pretty awesome. It is not news that there's going to be a panel. That was already confirmed. What is new is the confirmation of who's going to be on the panel. So according to an article from Entertainment Weekly, EW, it's going to be, of course, Sam Katrina, as well as Diana and Ron and Meryl. And we are going to have Tobias is back. He was not there last time. We have Richard Rankin and Sophie Skelton. I think I have everyone.
God, now I have to get close in Ballroom 20.
Now you have to go in and like hold, you can't hold seats, but you know, now you have to go in and like, you know, well, take care of business.
I do.
It's weird. You do, and don't wear Spanx.
Ginger, stop talking about Spanx.
You are the one who made the whole story last time.
And then I let it go, and you keep bringing it up.
I haven't brought it up in 2 years.
That's a lie. You brought it up like 2 weeks ago.
Exactly, but that's been that's 2 years.
That's not 2 years.
Okay, so that's definitely an announcement. And of course, we can plug again our fan panel.
Well, no change, and they also have scheduled autograph signings at the booth at 4029. They'll be doing autograph signing. On the Saturday. And I'm pretty sure that's usually done by like raffle tickets of some kind.
Yes, it's usually done. The two times that Outlander was there, because I took part in the first one. I did not take part in the second one. And the reason was because I was too tired. I think we might have been able to take part if we wanted to deal with the crowds. But in 2014, when they first were there, my friend Marifel and I went to, you know, we hung out at the booth, went to the panel and had little tickets or tchotchkes, whatever they gave you, whatever you needed to get into the signing. And we ran our booty up. It was bad because it went panel, autograph signing, go get ready for premiere. It was literally that back to back. We had to like walk. I don't even think we got a taxi. We may have, but we had to like take a taxi, and like our backpack had all of our crap in it to go change. And then you were being dropped off. We were doing the red car. It was ridiculous. It was so much fun, but it was ridiculous. So yes, typically it goes, if they do it the same way. Now, I was not part of it in 2014, the press part of it, but I believe the press roundtable or anything they had was again before it. I know in 2015 it was, because I was part of that. So it goes press, most likely, panel, typically followed by autographs. So it's funny, or not funny, haha, but funny like, oh, well, okay, you know, it could just be they're super busy and who knows,
no,
you know,
Sam's. I think that's really late for an autograph signing.
Because
they won't be done till 6. And the last.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, last time they did it, I think we had a 4 o'clock.
Yeah, it was a little bit earlier.
So they went from the 4, it was like 4:45 is when the panel got out. And then I think they ran over to do the autograph signing at that point. But I don't think they start autograph signings at 6 p.m. That's kind of
no,
late.
I mean, I think they physically could, but I think you're right. I didn't. That was like the one thing I didn't consider was the time after, because it's at 5, right? 5 to 6?
Yes. Well, 5, okay. Probably to 5:45. There's usually a 15-minute grace.
So, and we still have no knowledge because we haven't heard anything yet. We're not in possession of any knowledge yet of any official press or at least roundtable stuff yet. But presumably that would be before, because again, after is a little bit late either way, whether it's press afterwards or signing afterwards. You're right. I think it's a little bit late. But
it depends on if they do roundtables, because last year, like Hannibal was at the, or 2 years ago, Hannibal was at the 5 p.m. and they went from that to It wasn't a press round table. That was like,
oh, it was that open room thing.
Yeah, that was intense.
Oh, weren't you and Sarah there?
Yeah, I went with Sarah, and we were. Oh, she's like, pretend you're my cameraman. Go take pictures. And I was like, I don't belong in here. And but it was just everyone. It was like what you see at like the
White House press briefing.
Yeah. Yeah, like where everyone's just shouting out questions. And I mean, they were waiting their turns, but it was like hands raised, waiting their turns. But I mean, that was like everything you expect a press call to be, as opposed to when you talk about round tables, you're like, no, we all sit at tables very demurely. Everyone kind of comes from table to table and everyone gets a little bit of time. Yeah, this was not like that at all.
I don't know. I think that would be scary.
And now on to our read-along.
Chapter 58, Mask of the Red Death. Lisa T. writes, the title of this chapter is from the poem The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. It is the story of a mask ball held by a prince who is trying to entertain his people while the land is being ravaged by the Red Death. The night ends when the prince and his guests are dying from the Red Death. A rather ominous title for a chapter.
And, you know, the interesting thing, the thing that makes that story so creepy and bizarre is not just that they all die, it's that death is one of the guests at the mask. He's there in his...
Oh, well, hello, you just gave this you just gave the chapter away. I'm just kidding. Totally, no, that's true.
But, yeah, I kind of love it, Drown Post.
So. That's a huge parallel. Go Diane and go Diana, goodness. So Eileen P. writes, when I read the chapter title, Mask of the Red Death, my first thought was of the Red Wedding in Game of Thrones. That does not bode well. So they're going to a ball, and Jamie's wearing a wig. Claire quotes A.E. Housman. She'd read a lot of him at the hospital in between calls. That was one of the books that was there. And Jamie was a sight. Quote, red-heeled shoes and silk stockings clocked in black.
I think it really is clocked.
Oh, clocked. Okay.
Yeah, the clock
that's a way.
The stocking is, it's like the part between the transition where the heel meets the ankle. And I can send you some pictures if you want for the show notes. It was really popular to do like embroidery there to kind of enhance the shape of your leg and make your calf look shapely. And that, so yeah, they're called clocked stockings. And I only know that because I really want to make some.
Well, heck, maybe I need to get some clocking.
Yeah.
That's
some clockings.
Cool.
I'm going to call them clockings now.
There you go.
There's your claimie for this episode. He's wearing clockings.
Oh, gosh. Red-heeled shoes and silk stockings clocked in black, gray satin breeches with silver knee buckles, snowy linen with Brussels lace 6 inches deep at the cuff and jabot. The coat, a masterpiece in heavy gray, with blue satin cuffs and crested silver buttons, unquote. Okay, dude, Terry has a map. It is going to be... Look, they have to do what they have to do, but
absolutely.
She said, I'm pretty sure that whenever they have something so detailed, they do their best to like do it justice.
This is going to be like Jamie's version of the red dress.
The red dress. Exactly. Exactly. So what I love the most is that he adds a false beauty mark. Oh my gosh. That is too much. And Claire said
that he powders his hair, does she? Because, you know, I mean, it would be de rigueur, but...
Well, he was wearing a wig, so...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the wig is powdered.
There you go.
So she says that he looks like a gargoyle. That's brilliant.
We've been watching Harlots on Hulu, and it just makes me think of... What's his name that is the jealous master who winds up with both the sisters and
oh yeah,
you know, and he has the horror, he has just one dumb outfit after another and they make him look kind of foppish, but he has some pretty fabulous wigs.
So Fergus disagrees. He says, no, he looks like a Frenchman who is now 6'7" because Frenchmen are so tall.
Maybe he looks like two Frenchmen.
He says, as long as his hair is covered, they should be okay. And they won't be looking at him. She had a violet silk skirt cut low in the front with plenty of décolletage filled with lace. No pearls, but he does have a fish pin for her, made of black coral. He had gotten it the day before when he and Fergus were at Montego Bay. Now, you know, as soon as I read that, I was like, you know, I want to start singing like, that's where we want to go to get away from it all.
Absolutely.
Way down in Kokomo. Okay, that's it. Lisa T. writes, Jamie, who has often disguised himself, think Dunmonnet, and used multiple aliases, has physically transformed himself completely. I wonder how much of this we will see in the show. The thought of Sam in 3-inch heels, all powdered up and dressed like a Frenchman, is most interesting. It does get me thinking about a certain naughty hot conte. Fantasy digression here. Joe B. writes, written at the time of Oscar Wilde's 2-year sentence for gross indecency, i.e. homosexuality. And that is, I believe she's referring to, I think, Houseman?
Yeah, I think that's what she's talking about.
Okay. It none too subtly infers that to imprison someone for this act is equivalent to sentencing them for the color of their hair. And red hair has had long associations with the devil. And she provided a link, which we will include in the show notes. Jamie thinks half the people will be looking at her and the other half at Mr. Willoughby. Mr. Willoughby was dressed up too. Jamie says that no one from the Porpoise is likely to recognize her the way she's dressed now. Fergus is going as well, wearing his own hair, and so is Marsali. Diana writes, she glowed somewhat more than I thought the dress accounted for, unquote. And she asks her if she'd been using the tansy oil. Well, well, well.
Young love and all that.
Young, exactly. She's like, look, we're just, we only had like 3 nights together. Or no, more than that. Eileen P. writes, well, so much for tansy oil as a method of birth control, or perhaps Marsali just didn't bother using it. Leary's going to be a grandmother. The governor's mansion is decked out. They go through the receiving line, and then she sees Lord John. He stood apart from the other dignitaries, alone. He sees Claire first. She sees how handsome he is. He says that Captain Leonard had said that she was unwell, and he wouldn't admit, Captain Leonard, that is, would not admit to losing her overboard.
That would not look good.
No, not a good thing to put on your resume as ship captain.
Exactly. It's like, oops, we lost someone. I don't know how it happened.
And a useful one, too.
No kidding. She turns to introduce Jamie to Lord John. The latter is, quote, green as a gooseberry. Looks back and forth between her and Jamie. Jamie says quietly, let us make an opportunity to speak a bit later. And for now, my name is Etienne Alexandre, unquote. And he introduces her as his wife, Claire. John is shocked. This is Claire? Now, Claire has absolutely no idea why this is such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Erica B. writes, being officially introduced to Lord John, it's like Claire is a ghost again, similar to when he saw Jenny for the first time after returning. Of course, he being Jamie. Lord John is stunned. It's curious, though, that Claire didn't make the connection that if Lord John was friends with Jamie during the time he thought she was dead, that he might have thought her dead also. That's true. That's a good point. Even if Jamie didn't elaborate, actually, I have something to say about that. Even if Jamie didn't elaborate about Claire, we get the understanding that he told Lord John the very basic fact that she was dead. Well, that's the whole point. Even if she, I think he said that she was gone.
Yeah, he was saying that she was gone and made it very clear, like, he didn't want to talk about his wife.
Exactly. So John probably assumed she was dead, and understandably so. And so I think his shock is completely in line with what Jamie had told him.
Yeah, and I think, too, because they kind of got to know each other previously, and they didn't get off to a great start. She was not very happy with him. He was kind of frustrated with her. Why won't you just, fix my men, and et cetera. But they do kind of come to this understanding about each other. But yeah, why would he assume that just because she had this first name of this guy that he knew 20 years ago that, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, the combined shock of first seeing Jamie in that way you know, again, this random halfway around the world encounter, and then Jamie being like, oh yeah, this is my wife, Claire. You know, you can imagine what's going through his mind. I thought she was dead. Maybe I thought I was going to have Jamie to myself to be my friend and, you know, not have to share with some weird wife. And also he's thinking about the interactions he just had with Claire and what kind of person she is. And, you know, I would be pretty speechless in a similar situation, I think.
They continued on. People were fascinated by Mr. Willoughby, who was looking at women's feet, of course, and especially the name of the woman, Marceline Williams. She introduces them to the Stevenses. So basically, part of Jamie's plan was that once they got there, they don't need to go out of their way to do much, because the fact that they're there and, you know, the novelty of them being there will entice enough people to basically do their work for them.
Mm-hmm. It's a small,
or help them do their work.
And, you know, exactly. Just the fact that they're sort of an object of curiosity as these new interesting people, that it's going to kind of do the job for them.
Exactly. So she, Marceline Williams, introduces them to the Stevenses. And within an hour, Jamie had been introduced, introduces her, because they just take Claire. Mm-hmm. Within an hour, she'd been introduced to loads of people. Jamie was making the rounds as well. She had no clue what he was up to, though. Fergus and Marsali are dancing the night away. And interestingly, Diana notes that Fergus didn't use his hook that night. He used a black leather glove filled with bran and pinned to the sleeve of his coat. I thought that was pretty ingenious. Claire danced with various people, and Mr. Willoughby was also very popular. Claire begins to ask about Abernathy. She asks if Mrs. Abernathy has indentured labor as well as slaves. The conversation continues, and Claire slips away. She sees Jamie chatting up a tall, young redhead, and sees it as him looking at the daughter he'll never see. Claire continues to the retiring room. She wanted to lie down for a bit, but duty called. She's concerned about Lord John's reaction to her name. As she walks toward the refreshments, she bumps into Reverend Campbell. She says she's sorry to hear about his sister. He's not happy to be there, and he's in quite a bad mood. Hating on Prince Charlie and the papists. Quote, he has destroyed the House of Stuart. He will destroy that man Fraser as well. Wait, what? Fraser? Who? Quote, that is the name of the man who seduced Margaret from her family and her proper loyalties. It was on his account that she left her home and safety, unquote. He goes on about God, this and that, how he wouldn't approve, and he just stares daggers at Willoughby and the women surrounding him. Willoughby is now on the floor pretending to look for something. Of course, looking at feet. The Reverend is offended at this whole thing and leaves. Then she sees Jamie heading for a door across the room, and she follows. But by the time she's through the door, he's gone. She continues through the hallway, her steps conveniently muffled by the carpet. She hears a murmur of male voices, and she sees a door that must be the private office of the governor. And all she hears is Jamie say, I'm not going to say it probably in the right tone, but, oh God, John, something like that. But, well, not like that, but something like that.
Yeah.
Diana writes, quote, I stopped dead, halted much more by the tone of that voice than by the words. It was broken with an emotion I had seldom heard from him, unquote. She goes forward and peeks in. His head is bowed, and he's in a tight embrace with Lord John. She then sees on his face, quote, a look of such naked hunger that the blood rushed to my own cheeks when I saw it, unquote.
And that's on Lord John's now, face, right?
Yes, she yeah. can only yes, she can only see Lord John's face, because exactly. Jamie's back is to her. She drops her fan. Out of shock, she drops her fan and runs away. Lord John hears this. She runs away and she gets back to the salon and stops behind a potted palm to hide, you know. And she feels slightly sick, and she is just utterly confused. Lisa T. writes, Claire hasn't figured out who John is yet, but as I wrote in my notes, this is a giant oh shit moment for John. I think it's mortifying for him, but it's also heartbreaking. Even though John knows that Jamie will never be with him, seeing Jamie with the person that he loves more than life has got to hurt. I cannot wait to see David in this scene. Now, the fact that Lisa wrote David is like, gave me like shivers, like, oh my God, that's right. We have David. What's his name? David Barry. Oh my God. It's like, we have Lord John. Oh my God. He's the one I think I'm most looking forward to seeing in season 3.
He's one of my favorite characters.
Oh my gosh. Well, I like Lord John anyway, but I, now that we're getting him embodied.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh my God. Him and Willoughby, I think.
I really hope they, well, not to get off too much on a tangent.
Okay,
I'm really
girl, have you heard me? Have you heard me tonight?
That's true. Let me tell you about what I was doing in 1998.
Oh gosh. That's just mean.
I'll be really interested to see what they do with Mr. Willoughby as season 3 of the TV show comes up, because I know Diana's gotten a little bit of criticism that it seems her portrayal of him seems a little paternalistic and a little bit stereotyped. But I think the world has progressed a lot from where it was as far as issues on, you know, being culturally sensitive since the early mid-90s. But I would love to. I'm so excited. This is my favorite book in the series, and I'm definitely ready to see what they do with it.
You know how I felt before last year. The DIA is my favorite.
Yeah,
it's so exciting, isn't it? My next big huge thing, I hope that gets renewed. I hope it gets renewed. My next is like book 6. I'm like, oh my gosh, if we get there, holy crapola. Book 6 is like another freaking world.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Epic for sure.
Oh my gosh. Well, they're all epic, but book 6 to me is like, oh,
yes.
Shitballs. Okay. Yeah. That's again, another digression. So Claire feels betrayed. This is Lisa T continuing. Jamie has neglected to tell Claire about important things in the past. Think about Larry. Now that was bad enough, but this is much harder for her to deal with on several levels. I think she is most upset because she feels like Jamie didn't trust her enough to tell her about John. Exactly. What about John? We don't know yet, but John at period. The fact that he's friendly with him.
I was just going to say, I think too, she sees how much passion or love John clearly has for Jamie. And I mean, if I were in that situation, I'd be going, well, but what does Jamie think and feel? What is Jamie not telling me? You know, what if Jamie feels the same way? What if when he says, oh yeah, he's my friend from Ardsmuir, you know, Claire could read all kinds of things into that. And I believe in DIA, there's a little bit of her reminiscing about, you know, men traumatized during her war years, and, you know, turning to each other for comfort or having relationships with each other because that's just how they're wired. But I for me, reading that scene, what I've always taken from it is Claire's freak out is not just that, oh, this is something I didn't know about, but I have no idea what Jamie's part in this is, especially with what happened with Leary. You know, what else is Jamie hiding from me? Because I think she would be crushed if it turned out that Jamie had feelings and had a relationship with John too, especially in light of what happened with Blackjack.
Oh gosh, exactly.
Well, and I certainly think, and without going into too much detail about what happens in the rest of the book, because I don't want to spoil anyone, but we definitely, I think at this moment, and for a while, kind of get the impression that Claire is a little bit homophobic. And it's not like a deliberate
she's
thing.
She's a product of her time. Yeah,
yeah, it's just something that she's not really considered before, I think. And, you know, I think most of us have at some point experienced some kind of unrequited love. And it's, you know, it's such a difficult and heartbreaking and, like, really strongly emotional thing. So you can only imagine what the look on John's face might be. You know, he probably thought he was going to go most of the rest of his life without ever seeing Jamie again. And to suddenly see him and to be getting, you know, give him a hug, he's probably kind of overwhelmed. And that's a really vulnerable moment that Claire has seen him in. She has no idea what's going on. All she knows is that Jamie knows this guy from Ardsmuir. She doesn't know if Jamie slept with him at some point.
She sees that lustful look in John's eyes, yeah.
Yeah, and so she's probably just, like, you know, incredibly shocked and probably having a little bit of a flashback to what happened with Lyra, you know, with just, is this something else that's going to ruin everything I thought was good and great again?
You got to have a lot of trust for someone to come back after not seeing them for, you know, 18, 19 years and just be like, oh yeah, I'm sure you didn't do anything that you wouldn't be happy to tell me about in its entirety. And, you know.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, that unsureness of, are you still that same person? Do we still know each other? Do we still have this? And it's like the scene we were talking about earlier where she gives him the little raspberry on his belly. Like, she's just getting comfortable with him. She's just feeling like, okay, I'm safe in this relationship.
Erica B. writes, I can feel Jamie's excitement at the idea of being able to visit Lord John to surprise him. It's so great to visit a long-lost friend, and this one for reasons yet to be discovered in a later chapter. Now, Claire knew at his surprise of her and his look at Jamie, how Lord John felt about Jamie, but she wasn't sure about Jamie. She couldn't see his face. She goes straight to, quote, he was the governor of Ardsmuir Prison. And another conversation pops in her head. Do you ken what men do in prison? She was convinced that there was absolutely no way Jamie could ever do that. Not after BJR. And she's feeling ill. She sees the governor return to the party. And a few minutes later, Johnny? Who's Johnny? He's the backup. He's not the second. What do you call it? The body double.
Like a pompadour and a leather jacket. You know, maybe a motorcycle.
A leather jacket, exactly. Here's Johnny. Jamie comes out. Quote, his mask of cool reserve was in place, but I knew him well enough to see the marks of a strong emotion under it. But while I could see it, I couldn't interpret it. Excitement, apprehension, fear and mingled joy, or something else. I had simply never seen him look that way before, unquote. He was looking for her, but she couldn't face him, not with the crowd. She runs to the retiring room. She smells something, and she sees Mina Alcott lying on the chaise, her throat sliced open, and she freezes. Then someone came in behind her and sees it too. And, quote, in the moment before the screaming began, I saw the footprints leading toward the window, the small, neat prints of a felt-soled foot, outlined in blood, unquote.
Say it ain't so, Mr. Willoughby.
No, please don't. Please say you didn't do that. Eileen P. writes, well, this is shaping up to be quite some party for Claire. First, Reverend Campbell accuses Jamie of having seduced his sister, Mary Campbell. Then Claire witnesses the embrace of Jamie and Lord John. Now she discovers the murdered boy. Now she discovers the murdered body of Mina Alcott, and it appears Mr. Willoughby is the murderer. Thankfully, this is the end of the chapter, and I'd hate to think what would happen next. And finally, Erica B. writes, Claire is utterly confused as to what is happening between Lord John and Jamie, and is clearly upset at what is running through her mind when she heads to the retiring room to clear her head. And upon her arrival, needless to say, I can only imagine she's thinking of a choice four-letter word when she spots Willoughby's footprints. How much worse can this night get?
So true. It's just piling on and piling on for Claire.
Oh my gosh. It is like one bungle after another. Before I close out, do you want to like wrap up these three?
Not really. I mean, that's kind of a good cliffhanger to go from.
What I like about this chunk of the book is it's such a huge transition from their time at sea to settling into life on Jamaica. And it's kind of strange to think how far through the book we are already, because it feels like this could be the start of a story. But, you know, mostly I just love that excellent visual of Mina draped over the couch and, you know, good cliffhanger ending. That's the kind of writing from Diana I really like. She does good murder mystery.
You know, what this whole book and especially this section make me think of, there's a series of books I really, really like by the author David Eddings. And it's two trilogies with this main character, Sparhawk. And one of the things someone mentions in one of them is he uses the phrase, "Our Holy Mother Church reels from crisis to crisis like a drunken sailor." And I really feel like Jamie and Claire do a lot of that too.
That is very true.
Oh my gosh.
Crisis.
You know, dealt with the thing with the porpoise. She's had to jump off the ship. Jamie's rescued her. You know, they think everything's going to go okay. They've landed there. She's got a bath and everything. And then suddenly there's a murder on top of the, did my husband sleep with this man in jail?
Oh my gosh. It's like, yeah, they just can't get away. They can't get no breaks. They can't get no love. Oh my goodness. And it's so exciting because that's what I think out of all the books, even though it's not my number one or even number two favorite, Voyager and Echo, I think you have to say are the most adventurous. I would put Voyager first and then Echo, because, and then the funny thing, and I don't want to spoil it by saying what they have in common, because that I just don't want to. But if you have read them, you'll know what I'm talking about. But they both are so full of adventure, and especially Voyager, when they're not only like on a ship, they're in like so many different places. It's just, it's crazy town, and adventurous like travel and adventurous in different places, but also adventurous in like this. I mean, gracious, there's like so many elements. There's a murder mystery. There's like a there's still Jamie and Claire. So there's romance, maybe not a romance, but they're a romantic couple. Mm-hmm. There's new love, new romance with Fergus and Marsali. There's maybe a new Bebe coming up. I mean, there's so many things happening, and then you get, well, we haven't gotten there yet, but there's like Alice in Wonderland craziness coming in. Like, was someone on drugs at some point? I'm just kidding. So much, so many aspects here.
It's wild. And I think part of the reason she's able to do that as a writer is that we know so many of the main characters already. I mean, we know Jamie quite
yes,
really well.
Yes.
We know Fergus, we know Leary, we know Jenny and Ian, and we know some other people who have yet to be revealed. So she's like, okay, the characters are already here. I don't have to spend half the book letting you get to know them. She can just get right into the action. And it feels more cinematic to me because it's you're just thrown right in. There's no flirting around with, and then I met this person, and this is what they looked like, and this is what they did, and then this is how I knew whether they were good or bad or not, because it's just like the cards are on the table.
Exactly. If your main characters are with you still and you don't have to develop them, you know, much, you have a lot more freedom. You have a lot more space, a lot more blank space, a lot more time to fill. That doesn't have to be development of them.
Right. To tell a bigger story.
Exactly. And more nuance, more craziness, more excitement, more adventure.
And she certainly has a very broad canvas to use.
Oh my gosh. That's one thing you can never accuse her of is lack of a fertile imagination. Oh my goodness. So thank you guys so much for coming on and hanging out.
Thanks for having us.
Yep. Great to talk with you.
Always, always, always. Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.